Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. A stock surge that had us scratching our heads. Major indices rebounding from yesterday's sell-off in a big way, even with a slew of evidence that the Fed may not cut rates anytime soon. What gives? We'll try to decipher the action ahead of a busy week. Plus, a high-energy trade, crude oil hitting its best level since October, the S&P energy sector at all-time highs. Can the rally keep rocking, and how should you play the moves? And later, a rally 10 years in the making. The Chartmaster has his eyes on this name that just recouped a decade's worth of losses. We'll find out what it is and where he says it is going later this hour. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Guy Adami, Mike Coe, and Julie Beal. We start off with a perplexing end to a volatile week. Stocks surging on Friday with the S&P gaining more than 1% and nearly erasing all of yesterday's losses. The Dow and Nasdaq also higher today. The gains come even after a hot jobs report pushed the prospect of rate cuts further down the road. The economy adding 303,000 payrolls in March, more than 100,000 above expectations. That took the possibility of a June cut down from more than 65% yesterday to about 50-50 right now. Add to that more hawkish talk out of the Fed. Central Bank Governor Michelle Bowman adding to the chorus today, saying another rate hike might be needed. A hike might be needed if inflation remains high. We'll get more data on that next week with CPI and PPI reports both on the calendar, not to mention the kickoff to Q1 earnings season. And if all that wasn't enough, the ground was literally shaking under investors' feet this morning when a 4.8 magnitude earthquake hit the New York, New Jersey area. So after a hot jobs report, all this Fed speak, an actual earthquake. What happened today? What happened?
Well, and Mercury's in retrograde, which explains if Guy's a little moody, apparently that's one of the byproducts. But, and my wife tells me the locusts are coming. And we have an eclipse next week. So, yes. I mean, take cover. But if you think about the week, and we question whether it was the geopolitics that were front and center yesterday, or really whether it was the chorus of Fed speak. And again, I'll just say it was the chorus of Fed speak. A week after the Fed lit the market on fire, the Fed had to dial it back this week. But when you get a payroll number, that Guy, cover your ears, I think was Goldilocks. You have a combination of you had wage growth, but it wasn't too hot. You had a better participation rate for the labor force, which is broadening, which is very, very good. You have a payroll number that comes after a day when we questioned whether, the Fed was not going to let the economy breathe and was going to kind of squelch it out. So I think very impressive. I think the fact that earnings season is coming up next week, along with a couple inflation prints, you have everything to take the market higher. I know it seems as if you've got a dynamic here where this was a week where it was glass half empty on almost everything. And yet, look at that finish. I'm half full.
Throw that on top of the fact that clearly Tim is playing hurt today. He's a little hoarse. Do you hear that? No, but I appreciate that. He shows up.
I mean, there's no I in the word Tim.
let's not get carried away. But again, we play the game. If you had told me all these things, I mean, given yesterday's action, like we're down another 50, 60 S&P handles. Obviously, we're not. But the gold market then should have sold off today. Mm. The gold market actually went higher today. Bonds traded. Yields traded up, I should say. So many strange things. But I'll say this as well. The one thing that stuck out to me amongst all the things we just talked about, the fact that the VIX effectively closed unchanged. And I think it still has a 16 handle, which is remarkable given the run that it's had. And given that historically, when I say historically, the last couple of years, on a day like today, it would have been down a couple handles easily.
The other thing we didn't mention was that warning just yesterday that from the CIA saying that Iran might strike Israel in the next 48 hours. So that's still potentially on the table going into a weekend, Mike. We saw stocks higher. That also didn't seem to make any sense.
Yeah, I think what Guy was just talking about with respect to the VIX is pretty interesting. So even net of today's big rally, so a 1% move today, a 1% move yesterday, if you just take a look at the past 30 calendar days, really, the S&P is moving with about a 10% implied volatility, much, much lower than what the VIX is currently implying. And what that tells me is that some of these concerns that we're talking about, like the possibility of, a conflict directly between Israel and Iran is something that is being discussed. That kind of an environment, it shouldn't necessarily be good for equities. But the economic data, and I think this is what Tim was speaking to, has generally been pretty good. And, for as long as we're running as big a fiscal deficit as we are, that is the propellant, I think, that can sort of make up for the monetary propellant that we had in prior years. And I'm not necessarily saying that's a good thing from a budget perspective, but it is an element that helps support risk assets.
I mean, the unemployment rate remained under 4%. Participation rate went higher. This is the first time it happened in a while, Julie. I mean, are you also glass half full here? I mean, the growth is there, this jobs report is telling us.
Yeah, I think what I'm encouraged by is I find it pretty frustrating when we kept having, you know, good news is bad news because the focus is so much on the Fed. And what it really comes down to for your long-term stock returns are what's happening with earnings growth. And I think what, you know, the jobs data is showing us is that this is a very resilient economy that can handle a major increase in interest rates and still deliver on that. So the question then becomes is what does the earnings forecast look like for the rest of the year? And I think if we look to what happened in 2023, most companies were worried about a recession and they got themselves pretty trim and fit. And so I think we start to see the benefits of that from a margin standpoint going into 2024. So I'm, you know, it depends on the company, obviously, but I think we're in a good position, economically speaking.
So on this beautiful Friday, I mean, I don't want to be the Debbie Downer in the group, but since I play that role typically, I'll play it again real quick. I mean, obviously, look, a lot to love, 3.8% in terms of the unemployment rate. Here's one of the reasons I think, you know, yields might have gone higher, because if you look at the trajectory between full-time jobs now and part-time employment, those are crossing over the wrong way. Part-time employment is going through the roof. Full-time jobs are going down. That tells me, and this is just my interpretation, people need more jobs, two jobs, because they're trying to combat inflation any way they can. And that, to me, reeks the fact that inflation is still a huge problem.
You want to find
Of course I do. Of course I do. But I started by saying it
that
way.
That was the one, that was the thing.
Yeah. Well, So let Debbie have his way. And I think you've got a case here, though. If rates are higher and there's a backdrop that I think at some point we know there are sensitivities to the equity market in higher rates, whether it's 4.5, whether it's going to be 5 again. This was a week that was also interesting because, you know, with Microsoft got all-time highs, you know, you have these upgrades of Meta and Google. So whether it's Fab 4, you know, Super 5, you know, less than 7, but, you know, in addition to the 493, the fact to me that we could get the 12.5% earnings growth that the market's expecting, and even if it comes from this group of stocks that are going to do better when rates move higher. So for the market itself to move higher, you still need that participation. Meanwhile, again, it was a week where, look at airlines, look at Delta. You know, we're going to talk about United, they have their own issues, but look at banks, look at industrials, look at transports. I mean, the participation is here, and it's not just that, you know, energy and healthcare, which have particular drivers behind them. I think it, you know, it is a market that's getting everything.
Are you constructive of the markets? Are you bullish the markets? Are you reluctantly bullish on the markets?
Very reluctantly bullish. It doesn't mean I think you're chasing here, and this is part of the problem. And we know all the money that's on the sideline in terms of money markets and whatnot. And I think it is kind of that wall worry that still makes me feel like we have to go higher. I also just, you know, I point this out because we're talking about Mercury retrograde, and we're talking about all these other things that are more astrological. This is one of the best investment times of the year. April is one of the best months of the year, especially for the NASDAQ and especially for mega cap tech. So it's hard to ignore that, even though then we get right into selling May, go away in June.
So the seasonality issue.
Julie,
are you bullish too? Are you reluctantly bullish? How do you feel?
I mean, I'm always pretty reluctantly bullish. I mean, I'm often told by clients I'm the gloomiest growth investor they've ever met. So I'm always worried about what is lurking behind, but I do feel more optimistic, seeing more broadening both in jobs and also in terms of what's happening in the stock market. That makes me feel a little bit more optimistic.
Do you think earnings will deliver, Guy?
No.
You don't.
But I mean, you know, so color me a skeptic.
Everywhere?
Not everywhere.
What do you think is going to be the theme?
In the aggregate, I think the 200, I think it's $245-ish is consensus, and I think it's 12.5%, maybe 12% earnings growth this year. I just don't see that. The math doesn't work in terms of where GDP is, and in terms of, I think, with all these now reacceleration of inflation, I think that's going to hurt earnings. That's just my opinion. If it comes out and everything's fine, that's why the market is rallying. But I'll say this as well real quick. I mean, this is still since March 8th, that Friday. So what's that, 4 or 5 Fridays ago? That reversal in individual stocks that has not been violated. And to me, despite what we saw today, despite what we saw yesterday, still reeks of a potential short-term top.
All right, let's get back now to the March jobs report. The economy adding 303,000 jobs with the unemployment rate staying at 3.8%. Average hourly wages ticking up slightly. The labor force participation rate inching closer to 68%. That's encouraging to our next guest. Joining us now, Constance Hunter, senior advisor at Macro Policy Perspectives. Constance, thanks for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Why did you pick the participation rate out in particular?
Well, because it jumped up, and that's a really good piece of news, right? Because when you look at this headline number, you could say, oh my goodness, it's going to cause inflation to reaccelerate. And the crux of why it's not has to do with supply. So greater number of people supplying labor means that it's less likely to be inflationary down the road.
How does immigration factor into these numbers, in your view?
Yeah, immigration is a really important part of this. We are adding workers when we need them, right? So we had sort of a lower increase in immigration during the 2000s. So if you go back to the 1990s, we had a much larger flow of immigrants. We had a strong economy that often attracts people to come to the United States. And it also means companies are applying for the H-1B visas in greater volume. We're starting to see that again. We have a strong economy. Employers are looking to bring in workers. And of course, we have people coming here seeking work.
Hey, Constance, it's Tim. Thanks for joining us. You know, you're focused on macro. What's the move in gold telling you? This is somewhat counter to what the equity market is doing and maybe even what the bond market's doing.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, look, I'm not a gold trader. I remember starting my career on Wall Street when Wayne Angel was the gold bug, right, at Bear Stearns. And Bear Stearns got sued for him saying that gold was going to go up. It didn't go up. And he, you know, the defense was, well, he's just there for entertainment. So, look, people put gold into their portfolio when they feel insecure, right? It's like buying part of the zeitgeist. And if there's uncertainty, the value of gold will go up. We have a lot of uncertainty going on in the world, right? We have an unprecedented number of elections this year. We have a lot of geopolitical uncertainty. And I think whenever you have times of surging productivity like we have right now, because productivity is not well understood, right? It can cause increased volatility. That increased volatility also may cause investors to flock towards gold.
So, Constance, on the macro front, again, I think within the last month or so, we exceeded the 1978 to 1980 duration of an inverted yield curve. So it's the longest inverted yield curve since we started taking this data. Does that mean anything anymore? A lot of people say it's different this time. What is your sense?
I mean, look, it's certainly a concern for the banks that have the held to maturity securities that are at a loss because of that inverted yield curve. They're not lending out money at the same rate. So we're seeing it in the senior loan officer survey. We're seeing it in the willingness of banks to lend and them keeping extra cash on the balance sheet. At the same time, we're also seeing the willingness to borrow decline. Right. So you do see tighter liquidity conditions because of that inverted yield curve.
Constance, I'm wondering how you view how many cuts we will get this year and if that view has changed in the past 48 hours.
Yes, it has. So we have dialed back the number of cuts to 3 cuts this year. We still think there's a very good chance that they move in June because our forecast for the progress on inflation is fairly aggressive over the next several months as we start to see lower rents feed through into that rent component of core PCE. But we only think that they are going to cut 3 times. And by the way, this we have been saying for a little while, this is very reminiscent of the 75 basis point cuts that we got in the 1990s and a situation that perplexed the Fed and the market then, when we had a productivity surge and we continued to have stronger growth, lower inflation with interest rates remaining fairly elevated.
Constance, thanks for joining us.
Thank
Constance
you so much.
Hunter. Where do we stand, Mike? Where do you stand on the narrative that zero cuts would actually be the best thing for equities because it would show that the economy is actually pretty good? Versus 3 cuts, because it seems like the market vacillates between it being a good thing and it being a bad thing.
I think it's unhealthy for us to think that rates should, you know, be chronically well below, say, the 10-year well below 4%. I mean, everybody who's on the desk right now, up until the GFC, the rates that low actually would have indicated there was a real economic problem. So we should have an economy that can sustain itself and presumably grow with the 10-year above 4%, which is where it was for 50 years up until the GFC. So, I mean, we shouldn't necessarily need to have rates lower. The problem, though, is that as I think Guy was probably pointing out here, is that you in order to justify these valuations, you either have to see stellar earnings growth or you need low rates, because we are at above average historical valuations here for equities and other risk assets. And that's the dilemma I think that investors are facing right now. You need to have, you know, one or both of those things to justify the levels in the S&P right here.
Meantime, we are getting some news on Tesla's robo-taxi as well as an investor day postponement from United. Phil LeBeau's got the details on both stories. Phil.
Hey, Melissa, let's start first off with Tesla. About a half hour ago on X, Elon Musk put out a very simple, short statement, but one that will get people buzzing. He says the robo-taxi will be unveiled August 8th. Now, this comes after a day where earlier today, Reuters put out a report saying that there had been meetings at Tesla where employees were told they're going to scrap plans for a $25,000 low-end car, and instead we're going to be focusing on robo-taxis. After that report came out, Elon Musk, also on X, said Reuters is lying again. All we know at this point is that we can expect to see what they are showing as the robo-taxi on August 8th. But there's no details in his comment on X. Does that mean it's a new vehicle? Does that mean it's a software platform? What's the date for the robo-taxi going into service? Lots of questions and speculation about what this will mean leading up to August 8th. And then let's shift gears and talk about United real quick. The company postponing its plan for an investor day on May 1st. That was when they were going to outline what their financial targets are, not only near term, but over the next couple of years. The company putting out a statement saying that doing that at a time when they are working with the FAA send the wrong message, saying right now our entire team is focused on cooperating with the FAA to review our safety protocols, and it would simply send the wrong message to our team to have an exciting investor day focused primarily on financial results. So United says it will likely hold an investor day in the fall. No date has been given at this point, but two stories that are getting attention after hours today. Melissa, back to you.
You know, Phil, the United news seemed kind of peculiar to me, since United is going to report its earnings on April 17th, and the investor day was after that. You would think that, you know, it would give that sort of guidance before 2 weeks beforehand anyway, so why cancel that investor day?
Well, you know how investor days go, Melissa. I mean, this is the one event that CEOs say we got to have our messaging. What's our messaging going to be? I would be there. Other reporters would be there. You know that other analysts or analysts who would be there would be asking questions about where do things stand with the FAA? What's happening in terms of your safety protocols? And if you're Scott Kirby, you don't want to spend the day answering those questions. You want your investor day to be focused on your financial results and your goals over the next couple of years. So I'm not entirely surprised that they've made this decision.
Okay. Phil, thanks. Phil LeBeau. Tim, you're an investor, correct? Were you looking forward to this investor day?
Well, it's, you know, first of all, sometimes I point out—
Are you making new plans now for May 1st?
Well, yeah, look, I'm completely, you know, now I can rearrange my sock drawer and do some other things. But I in airline stocks, sometimes I call myself a trader. In Delta's case, I'm an investor, and I've actually been a long-term investor, and I'm a long-term consumer of Delta. But I do think there's a dynamic here with United that continues to be a very different story than what we're seeing of the big two versus Delta. It's underperformed, by the way, by 25% over 6 months. And it is interesting. You have an investor day when you have good news. There's no question. So when you don't have an investor day, do you by default have bad news? That is something to think about. But I do think it's been an incredible run for airlines. I'm a little worried about the oil price. And I think that's what knocked Delta down from over $49, which was a key level.
Yeah. Julie, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Typically, also during these investor days for the airlines, they talk about what they're envisioning for their new routes that they're going to be planning. And the FAA has halted any new routes for United based on issues with their pilots. And so that really makes it a lot harder to get people excited about the future of earnings growth and what new markets we're going to go and attack if you can't really announce those specifically. So I think that's part of the reason, too. But I agree. I'm suspicious that there is more bad news to come. Typically, that's, you know, where your analyst day is, when you get to really trumpet everything that's going so well.
Robotaxi 8-8, which is an auspicious date. 8-8.
Is that, yeah?
I thought eights were lucky, though.
Eights were lucky, yeah.
8-1-8, 8-18, yeah. 1-8.
Anyway, no details.
Well, no details, and the stock, which underperformed a decent market today, has probably gotten all, I'm meaning Tesla now. All the losses we saw today, they've probably gotten it back. So Look, we'll see. There are typically no details. And on a Friday afternoon, the timing of both these, to me, are very odd.
All right. Coming up, a red carpet rally for Netflix as the streaming giant gets a big bullish call from Wall Street. Just how high can the stock go and what is going to drive the gains? That's next. Plus, a burger bummer for McDonald's, the fast food favorite, in its longest losing streak since 2022. What's behind that slump when Fast Money returns?
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee, right here on CNBC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. We've got a call of the day on Netflix that stuck up 3% after Pivotal Research raised its price target to $765. That's a new street high, about 20% higher from current levels and more than 9% above Netflix's all-time high hit back in November 2021. Analysts saying higher revenue growth forecasts are driving this call. You're in this.
Yeah, I am. And the bottom line here is it's not just growing revenue and subs that have been beaten to the upside, but it is a margin dynamic. And it's a story that has been a free cash flow, dare I use the term machine in the case, especially in a sector where this has been the whole story. So the free cash flow ramp, I think, is part of it. The organic growth is interesting. We're all waiting for Netflix to do something either lateral or more interesting, whether it's in gaming or, you know, they're dancing around the event, world. And, it's not entirely sports, but whether it's wrestling or whether it's one-off events in music and whatnot, and I think with the subscriber base they can do it. So I think you stay there. It's not cheap. Guys pointed this out, but maybe this is still a place it can exceed.
The analyst at Pivotal said that the Netflix has won the streaming war, and it's not just this analyst saying it. Bob Iger basically said this yesterday when he said that he wanted Disney to be number two, meaning that Netflix is number one. Mike, so has Netflix? Is it just Netflix's world at this point?
It would seem to be, right? So I think there was concerns, number one, that we had a lot of this sort of other over-the-top competition in the streaming world. They were suddenly going to be fighting against all of these other market participants. And they aren't losing, basically, their subscriber base. Maybe some other people are picking up Disney+. Maybe some other people are using other services here and there. But Netflix is maintaining. They were able to raise prices. This new price target is, 30 times, I think, full year 26 estimates of just over $25 a share. And really the question that people long had about it was, with the cost of content, was this company ever going to start generating free cash flow? And as Tim just pointed out, it finally did. And now it's really starting to print it. It's probably going to have $10 billion in free cash full year 2026. So I think the multiple is a little rich for me, given we're looking at, probably teens in terms of growth. But I see where you could get that number.
Bob Iger might have acknowledged it yesterday. He's been talking about it for 6 or 7 years. Tom Rogers comes on the show. He's been saying it forever. So all the research you see, I want to say it's predicated on what Tom said, but a lot of it has its sort of seeds and a lot of things Tom has been saying. With all that said, if you pull up a longer-term chart, November 2021, 645-ish, I believe, was that prior high. So we're right up against it. Yes, it's expensive. But you got some momentum working for you. So I think Tim's been right. Maybe you stay with it into the earnings release on the 18th. But I would be a bit leery of staying with it post.
A lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
A burger bummer, a high-energy rally, and the chart that has the Chartmaster mesmerized. Our traders are tackling today's seismic market moves, plus what crude's high-energy rally means for prices at the pump, and how oil stocks fit into your portfolio's profit pipeline with the high-flying sector at record highs. You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Investors not loving McDonald's this week. The stock closing with a sixth straight day of losses. That's its longest losing streak since September 2022. The company announcing on Thursday that it will buy all 225 of its Israel franchise stores for an undisclosed price. McDonald's facing months of decreased revenues, particularly in its Middle East markets, due to calls for boycotts. Is that what is ailing McDonald's, Tim?
I think McDonald's is suffering from a couple of things. They're suffering also from just a wealth of success during both COVID been kind of around it, growth of their digital program. There's been such a move in this stock. It's been one of the quiet winners over the last 5 years. We've heard in the last couple of weeks about what's going on in California around fast food, especially, you know, McDonald's is going to be hurt as much as anybody. I think the costs on the wage side in fast food are a big deal. I also think the affordability, which is part and parcel, if you force wages upon franchisees, they are going to have to raise prices, or they're going to have to fire people. That's it's an economic discussion and debate. But I think margin wise, McDonald's is in a tough place. I think the multiple isn't something that you need to chase here. I love this company. I've owned it, and I want to own it. I want to own it lower, and I think I'll get it below 250.
McDonald's already talked about the potential impact of that wage hike increase in California in the last earnings call, Julie. So we're sort of expecting that. The other flip side that Tim had mentioned is the cost side of it. I mean, we're learning now that all these fast food companies, these quick serve restaurants, they're not doing these heavy promotions as they used to do once upon a time. They're relying much more on sort of very calculated, targeted sort of promotions that rely on loyalty points and things like that, as opposed to dollar menus, which was the way that they used to do it when inflation was not so much of an issue.
Yeah, I think that's right. Consumers have been struggling to find value everywhere they shop, right? It's not just, in fast food, and they're starting to see that just get continually eroded away, chipped away. And, what's interesting to me is seeing how the components are doing within fast food, right? We're shareholders of Lamb Weston, which does French fries. They have also seen a big gap down this week on much softer sales. And French fries are typically, the bedrock of any meal, or any of my meals anyway. It's surprising to see how that has played out for McDonald's. I'm pretty shocked, honestly.
You talk about strange day today is. I mean, yesterday when Karen thought Lamb Weston, which
was Lamb Research.
Full disclosure,
or
I had never heard of it
for that matter.
And then 2 days in a row, we're talking about this. Number one.
Okay.
Number two, McDonald's. We've known so a long time, 17 years to be exact. Mm-hmm. I have never heard them talk about their consumer basically trading down and being affected by prices like they did in their release. I think it was on February 8th or so. And real quick, if we could put up a chart, I mean, short-term double top in the chart has to scare people. Tim said he wants to buy it below 250. Guess what? That was right around the low from October of last year.
Coming up, the Chartmaster's very own chart of the week, the technical tale of the name that he is watching more closely than any other. That is next. Plus, a high energy rally, the energy sector hitting a fresh all-time high today as crude jumps above $87 a barrel. What it means for your profit pipeline and prices at the pump right after this.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money Podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks ending a losing week on a high note, bouncing back on Friday thanks to a strong jobs report. The Dow up 300 points, the S&P up more than 1%, and the Nasdaq jumping about 1.25%. Newmont Mining surging nearly 6% as gold hit a new intraday high today. The miner still negative on the year despite the commodities record run. And finally, Amazon closing at its highest level since July 2021 after Mizuho reiterated the tech giant as a top pick, saying it's bullish on the company's cloud business, AWS. Mike, what'd you make of the Amazon pop?
Yeah, I mean, this one has obviously had some pretty considerable strength along the way here. I mean, they're, along with Azure, basically the key players in this space, and it remains a business with the secular tailwinds. I probably feel that in the case of Amazon that, this run that we've had, I'm getting to a level where I'd probably like to sell some calls against the upside here. And in fact, the positions that we have, that's exactly what we've been doing.
Newmont, Guy, yes. I'm going to go to you on that. It is not a miner in your clam.
Thank God.
Yeah.
No, but Agnico,
there is a lot of good stuff in
there. There's some great stuff in the clam.
Stuffed with lots.
The
I mean,
A in the clam is Agnico. There you go. Agnico Eagle. And I think the gold move should be concerning. Tim talked about it. We've been talking about it for a while. Today was a day that people should have been historically would have been taking profits hand over fist in the gold market. They didn't do it. As a matter of fact, gold traded higher today. The miners starting to catch up, and I will reiterate, I still think we're in the early innings here.
I think if you look at that Newmont chart, it's just breaking out of the top of a channel, which is a downtrend. I think there's so much room to go in these miners. I think the analyst community has to upgrade just even on an average gold price.
Both WTI and Brent crude jumping this week as potential supply disruptions tied to tensions between Iran and Israel weigh on the market. WTI breaking through $87 today and forming a so-called golden cross with a 50-day moving average climbing above the 200-day for the first time this year. The move higher, taking energy stocks along with it, the sector locking in a record close with Valero, ExxonMobil, Marathon Petroleum, and Phillips 66 among the names hitting their own all-time highs. Tom Kloza expects more gains in oil. He leads a global analysis for the Oil Price Information Service. Tom, great to see you.
Hey, nice to be here. It's been quite a run. I think Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry, I was going to ask you, there's a seasonality issue and then there's a geopolitical issue kind of working in tandem at this point.
Yeah, and there's really the seasonality is the big thing. I mean, back in the fall when we had the Middle East war, it couldn't offset the tendency of the cycle to see crude oil prices drop by about 28%. Now we're in the time of the year where typically from a winter bottom to a second quarter high, we go up 30 or 40%. And we're probably in the sixth or seventh inning of that rally right now.
And you also think hurricane season could be worse than in past years?
Yeah, I would use the metaphor of the Bactrian camel for gasoline this year. We're kind of moving to the first hump right now. And typically, it'll be an old trade about a month from now, and a lot of people will get out of it. But that second hump, when we get into August and the Saudis are selling less crude because of air conditioning needs and the hurricane, chasers are out, that's when we really got to worry about it. And I think that'll be the second hump where retail prices will go. Who knows how much higher? I think this rally will stall out at about 375 to 390 for U.S. prices.
Well, that's interesting, Tom, because gasoline, I mean, we're typically 3 or 4 months ahead of when gas should start to get on its horse. And nobody's been talking about the gasoline move, except if you look at the refiners. So you mentioned sort of sixth, seventh inning. What inning do you think we're in for some of these refiners, which have been unbelievable?
Well, they're going to have great earnings and they're going to have great comments about the second quarter start going into the earnings in a couple of weeks. I do think that it'll come back a little bit. All three products, the three main products are gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. They're performing on all cylinders right now. It'll take a little bit of a break, probably on gasoline, because we're running so much light, sweet crude. But then at the middle point of the third quarter, I think the prices go higher again. And they go higher because there's a lot of storm chasers who will be long gasoline futures or options at that point.
Tom, it's Tim. Thanks for joining us. There's also a lot of chasers in the oil services space. And, you know, you've talked a little bit about the OIH in your notes. And you know, I have been very bullish on Schlumberger. The earnings ability and the operational leverage in their business is something that I think is significant, but hasn't been achieved. I mean, if you look at the heyday, we're talking about 2016, 2017. And so the company's not wicked cheap relative to its earnings power. Any thoughts here on when these drillers really start to shift into the next gear, even in a and just call it status quo for where we are in pricing?
Well, you know, there was a chart that was going around about a month ago that showed the XLE companies versus NVIDIA. And it was just an incredible chart. If you look at it since that month, the XLE companies have all gone up, whether on the production side or the refining side. And I think they're going to continue to do well. There's a lot of people that think the energy crisis peak demand occurs in 2028. But there's a lot of folks who think it's 2035 to 2040 as well. So that's pretty long lead time right now.
Tom, always great to speak to you. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Tom Kloza. Mike Coe, where are you in the energy trade?
We're long Marathon Petroleum. So we have that name on. Obviously, the crack spread has broadened pretty considerably over the course of the last couple of months and is still well off sort of the post-pandemic highs, although overall it is higher than it was historically prior to all of that. So I am starting to wonder whether we're getting a little long in the tooth for the short term in terms of the big move that we've seen in some of these names.
What is Tim's? Blicep?
Yeah.
Blicep.
I think the C in Blicep. Exactly. Yeah. And going back to the clam, if we may, on a Friday.
Yeah.
I mean, the C is either Chevron or Conoco. I forget.
Does it really matter?
It really doesn't. But I'll say what
it's
is
Conoco.
It is. That's what I thought. I mean, these stocks, I'm with Tom on this one. These stocks have done well. Tim's been all over this. You ride this energy wave, it's not going away.
Coming up, the lines may draw themselves, but we will have the chart master draw them for us anyway. What stood out to him this week and what the technicals are telling him. Plus, we're gearing up for the start of earnings season, and there could be some major moves when results cross the wires in the coming weeks. What Mike is seeing in the options pits when Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of GE soaring more than 11% this week after the company finalized its long-awaited separation into three different public companies. The gains for what is now the aerospace entity trading under the legacy ticker GE, taking the stocks to highs not seen since 2016. And it's our own Chartmaster's chart of the week. So let's bring in the man himself, Carter Braxton Worth of Worth Charting, for a look at this run. Carter.
Well, I mean, for starters, if you're the best single performing stock in the most important equity index in the world, probably you deserve to be chart of the week. So GE up 11.65%, number one, just beating out Newmont for the week in the S&P. But it's not so much that, it's also the level to which it has risen. So let's look at a GE chart. I have three of them. They're all identical and they are all weekly bar charts. And so what you see here is the first with no annotations, no judgments, no conclusions, no lines. Let's put some in. A second iteration. We know we have that epic sell-off. You're talking about going from 157 to 27. Of course, that's the unfortunate nature of math. When you drop 82%, you got to go up almost 500 to get back to where you were. A final chart. And what we have here is what it is, sort of an epic, if you will, head and shoulders bottom, and we have returned exactly to where we were some 8 years ago, which is remarkable, of course. So you have a stock that is unch for 8 years. The S&P is up 150% in the period. The QQQ is up 300. And remarkably, of course, for GE ever to get back to its all-time high of 295, it still has a lot of heavy lifting to do.
So from here, it's resistance. Is that the bottom line?
In the first instance, this is where options come into play. If I were long and it's steep and uncorrected, it's moved up 50% this year, you sell some calls, or you maybe sell some calls and use the premium to buy some puts or risk reversal. But I wouldn't just sit blindly long.
And Mike, what do you think of Carter's options advice?
Well, we had positions in GE. I actually peeled it all off today, or it should be all off come Monday when we take a look at all of the settlement issues. For those of you who had options in GE, by the way, the underlying change, and that's why when you're looking at your screens, things are a little bit screwy, because you can get 100 shares of GE and 25 shares of GEV for every options contract that you got. But I'm with Carter. I think this is obviously a terrific move that we've seen. We're very happy to participate in it. But, you know, having returned basically to the scene of the crime, as he often says, I figured we might just walk away from it here.
Julie, you like any of the GE companies?
Yeah, what I think is the most interesting about the GE companies is just seeing everything that Jack Welch built being slowly torn apart. And I think it really underlies the importance of capital allocation, which we don't maybe talk about enough. All of these acquisitions, all of these diversification where, you know, they try to expand out beyond their core competency. And it really is up to us as investors to kind of push back and say, focus on what you're good at.
Coming up, some huge earnings reports on the calendar for next week from airlines to big banks. We'll tell you how the options traders are setting up ahead of the results next. And here's a sneak peek at the Cramer Cam. Jim is chatting exclusively with the CEO of RBN Energy. Catch the full interview, top of the hour on Mad Money. Meantime, more Fast Money in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. We are gearing up for the start of earnings season. Tilray, Delta Airlines, big banks, Citi, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, all set to report next week. Mike Coe's got the read on how the options pits are bracing for them. Mike, what do you see in terms of the moves, the potential moves, I should say?
Yeah, I mean, as we would expect, cyclical types of stuff are going to see higher implied moves. That's going to include discretionary names and industrials. So taking a look at the industrial side and transportation, Delta Airlines, which we were talking about earlier, that's implying a move of about 5.4% in United, which we were also talking about is expecting a move that's even larger, around 6%. You take a look at something like Constellation, which is in the booze business. Unsurprisingly, not a lot of volatility expected there, less than 2%, and it doesn't typically move that much on earnings. Moving to a more discretionary type of name like CarMax, this thing is expecting a move of nearly 9% higher or lower. And of course, that is not surprising when you consider where we are in the rate environment as well as everything else. Financials don't typically move that much, and the quietest usually amongst the money center banks is JP Morgan. But the 3.2% that it's implying in the options market is actually a lot more than it typically moves, which is less than 2.
That is very interesting, the potential, the implied move for JP Morgan. Julie, what are you watching?
Definitely watching Delta. I'm really curious to see what they're talking about as far as business travel, since I really believe they're probably the best executor there. And I would love more of a sense of how that's going out for them.
Yeah, I agree. I think Delta is going to be fascinating to listen to with all that's going on in that sector. I have to kind of say Tilray also, because I run a cannabis ETF. Tilray is a core position. What's been going on in cannabis and for Tilray, especially because of the legalization across Germany, what's been going on also over here, what's been going on with their beer business. I think it's an interesting story.
Morgan Stanley, I believe on the 1st of April, they raised their price target to $85 in Delta Airlines from 77. I mention that because 49 has been the top for a while. Tim talked about that at the top of the show. We've been in this sort of 34 to 49 range. I tell you what, I mean, that's a pretty aggressive call into earnings next week. Sort of like the call. And real quick, 3% implied move in JP Morgan, given the run that stock has had, that sounds awful cheap to me. Just, I mean, I'm not saying Mike is wrong. He's obviously right, but that implied move to me doesn't make a lot of sense. I would think, given this run and given the environment that we're in,
The entire banking space. I mean, Citi's had a 70% move off that October pivot. So if you think of the money center banks, look at the move in Goldman. I mean, so it is fascinating this earnings season. Often every other earnings season, really for the last 2 years going into earnings season, has been a story of banks really underperforming. That is not the case here.
Mike, what do you make of that implied move for JPM?
Well, I mean, actually, it's the other banks that are all implying bigger moves. So you look at Citibank and Wells Fargo, all of those are more like the 4-5 territory. It's only JP Morgan is down around 3-2. And that's probably just because historically, this is probably the one where people just don't get a whole lot of surprises coming out of earnings. Some of these other names, Wells Fargo, and most notably, I would argue, and Bank of America, you know, with some of their balance sheet issues with longer dated paper on their books. Those are the ones that I think are probably more poised to move sharply than JP Morgan is.
All right. Up next, final trades. Final trade time, Julie Beal.
Tyler Technologies, you have nice, durable, sustained growth. That's good enough for me.
Mike Coe.
United Health into their April 16th earnings, but with a tight stop, that 450 level looks dangerous.
Tim Seymour.
Scary week. Be safe over the weekend. Watch out for the locusts. Sure. And this is a cozy little setup here on this desk. It's kind of
tiny
nice.
Desk.
Nice.
Tiny, small desk.
Tiny desk. Schlumberger's been certainly growing bigger from tiny, and I think this uptrend actually goes up to 64, 65.
SLB.
Props to Tim for playing hurt. And congrats to all the Met fans at Shea yesterday. They got off the schneid.
All five of them?
Exactly.
Oh,
I love that. Agnico Eagle Mines, Mel. Well done by you.
Thank you for watching Fast Money. Have a wonderful weekend. Be safe out there. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.